to our first end-of-year edition of Big Mouth. There's a world outside your window, and it's a world of dread and fear, but we've decided to banish and indeed exorcise 2016 by not going on about all the miserable things that happened this year. Instead, each of us are going to talk about three things that we loved this year, like the John Peel Fest of 50, but with 47 fewer things. And at the very least, it should give you something to chuck on your Christmas wish lists. My name's Andrew Harrison, and with me to spread peace and goodwill to all pop stars, movie directors, actors and so on, are our two special guests. She's a key member of the secret Welsh mafia that runs the music press. She writes for The Guardian, The New Statesman and The Pool Online. She's ex-Word magazine. She's folky, she's indie, and she's best mates with English folk ledge Shirley Collins. Look you, it's Jude Rogers. Hello, Judith. How are you?
I'm very well. Look you, it's Jude
Look
Rogers.
You, it's Jude. That should be your talk show.
Yeah, on my Twitter bio.
That'll be it. That's your Partridge talk show.
Yes. So we are trying to keep it on the up this time by not wallowing in misery. What's the nicest thing that's happened to you this year?
I moved to the countryside. That was great. But still, you know, I'm still in touch with you all, man. I met Johnny Marr.
Oh, yes.
That's probably my highlight of the year. I always get into trouble because I say my highlight of the year, and then, like, I met this pop star I've always loved, which 5 years ago I did that with Michael Stipe. I said, 2011, it was great. I met Michael Stipe. My husband went, we got married in April. So I moved to a beautiful place with my lovely family, and I met Johnny Marr. And he was really great. Fantastic. And he was wearing silver nail varnish.
And you left London. You followed Marky Smith's advice. You left the capital, exit the Roman shell.
Marky Smith isn't my neighbour, thankfully.
Okay. Also with us, he's the Guardian chief rock correspondent, or at least he's one of them. He's the author of the fantastic doorstep book, 33 and a Third Revolutions a Minute, about pop and politics. Like all right-thinking folk, he loves the Pet Shop Boys. It's Dorian Linsky. Hello, Dorian. How are you?
Hi, Andrew.
Are you all right today? So falling at the first hurdle of trying to keep it jolly, it has been a nightmare year in politics. Has it been tiring for you to keep having to do the music angle on political events?
Well, in a way, because there's been so much good political music, like that's the upbeat side.
Yeah.
But what I found difficult is because I'm sort of, politics is like a big hobby in a way. It takes up a lot of headspace. I'm just like, I'm really, really into both British and American politics.
Yeah.
Which means this year has been like horrible because it's like supporting two football teams that didn't just lose, but like members of them were just taken off and shot. It's
yes.
just been... And there were just times where I was just, people were like, how are you? And I was like, well, Trump won the election. Like, I mean, I had no real sense of like what else was going on in my life.
Yeah.
So it's more that. It's more like trying to wean yourself off being into politics when politics is so bleak. So the music side, if you can just listen to, you know, YG.
Yeah.
And I don't know if one can swear on this, but F Donald Trump.
Yeah.
They're rousing. Like, so, that's very cathartic.
So it's the cheering sort of, hey, I found a great record here that says we're all absolutely screwed. Isn't it great?
Yeah, but that's what, you know, that's what gets you through. The first political song I ever heard was Two Tries by Frank Goes to Hollywood. And I was like, on the one hand, oh my God, no one told me about nuclear war. Mm. On the other hand, let's party. So, you know.
Yeah.
Swings and roundabouts.
Swings and roundabouts, absolutely. That's enough politics. Also with us, operating the mixing desk in fingerless gloves by the light of a guttering candle, it's the Bob Cratchit to my Ebenezer Scrooge. Digital producer Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Yes.
Fantastic. Keep work harder, work faster. Actually, with your hip hop background, I think you're more of a Bob Scratchit, aren't you?
Can I not be the ghost faced of Christmas past?
Absolutely. Or Marley Marl, perhaps. Anyway, so what was the best thing that happened to you this year, Matt?
Do you know what? I've had a realisation that I've been held hostage by... I've got a kind of Stockholm syndrome about 2016 that I wake up in the morning and when the radio comes on, I'm now slightly disappointed that there isn't some kind of earth-shattering thing that happened overnight. So I'm quite glad that I've recognised that.
Mm.
And I'm now working towards not consuming the news media for the next 12 months.
Giving up news. Nice. Okay. Well, let's start with... we're going to start with Jude's selections, and we're going to start with, well, it couldn't be anything else, could it? It was the enormous heartbreaker of the year, but it was triumphant too because it reminded us that music can tower over everything else and give life the epic dimension that it deserves. It is, of course, David Bowie and Black Star. Jude Rogers bagsied it as the first of three Big Mouth Christmas choices from Black Star. This is the last track on David Bowie's last album. This is I Can't Give Everything Away.
Something's very wrong.
There's There's loads of air harmonica going down in the studio here. That was David Bowie, and I Can't Give Everything Away from Black Star, the last song on his last album. It seems ages ago, doesn't it? It seems like this happened a lifetime ago, the other side of a gigantic firewall of craziness. Jude, why is this the first of your choices? Stupid questions, number one.
I think it's important to remember when you're talking about David Bowie that, you know, his last record was a great record. Yes, there's lots of things in it that make you think about what was coming in his life, you know, at the end of his life. There's a lot of darkness. There's lots of, you know, even musically, you know, the kind of the honking kind of low kind of brass and all this kind of the jazz influences in it. You know, there's some quite dark moments, but it's really, it's glorious. It's funny listening to it recently, and I haven't listened to it for a couple of months, whereas the early in the year, you know, it was just like constantly listening to this album. And, you know, I wrote a piece about, you know, I went on the rabbit hole of the conspiracy theories. It's been really lovely listening to it again and hearing like the track we just played. You know, it's so great. You know, just there's this joy and this playfulness in the record as well, which people don't talk about as much because they're trying to think about, you know, the doominess that was in it. But
and actually,
you know,
it's not about death at all, is it? People think that it's purely and solely him confronting death. It's about life at a particular age from a particular vantage point.
Absolutely. And you know, the other big, you know, well, there's been lots of records about death this year, obviously. You know, the Leonard Cohen record, which we talked about marvellously on this podcast some weeks ago. Again, that playfulness, that liveliness, the humour, you know, The Girl of Me, you know, kind of there's the Polari and the Nadsat, and then there's like there's the Bowie kind of using, you know, fictional languages to, you know, kind of like the fact that he has obviously put things in this record to make you, you know, like in all his records, make you think about what he's doing, the references that he's dropping, and in all these little avenues that take you to different places. You know, that is really joyous, I think. Yeah. It's funny, kind of listening to it after going to the fantastic exhibition of his artwork. In Sotheby's a couple of weeks. I was in London for about an hour between doing jobs, and I was like, I can go to the Bowie exhibition. You know, seeing all the stuff that he'd collected and that was there, you know, that's what you should remember. You know, he gave us all these introductory kind of moments to different worlds, and that's what the best pop stars do. And
absolutely.
I think this album, you know, it's sad that obviously there was more stuff that he wanted to do, but, you know, we've got quite a lot of good stuff from him already.
Do we think, though, that, I mean, that big moment where, you know, after Bowie's death was announced, suddenly the whole world came out as, oh, I was always a Bowie fan. And it was a kind of moment. It sort of brought everybody together in a way that, you know, well, there's two or three people of the classic generation who we won't mention for jinxing it, but it's probably not going to happen again in that same way so many times, is it?
No, it was really.
It happened, I think, to a large extent with Prince as well.
Mm.
There was just a great sharing. And there's this thing about, you know, mourning, communal mourning online, which dicks basically go, ooh, look at you showing off. And it's a performance of grief. And it's not. I mean, as in kind of when you have actual real grief in your life, someone close to you, but you're not performing grief. You're trying to kind of like talk to people. Yeah. You're trying to kind of ease that. And the way that we have this trove now of not just like, oh, let's, you know, let's do a little link to Heroes, but you can go, oh my God, have you seen this Soul Train appearance?
Yeah.
Have you seen this interview he did on Wogan where he was really funny? There's this kind of like this endless array of even like sort of, you know, comments he posted on message boards. So you felt that you were kind of piecing together the whole man. And I think that Adam Buxton's Bug Bowie shows did this brilliantly, because it was like, on the one hand, yes, let's take him very seriously as an artist. On the other hand, let's laugh at this video he did in the late 80s. You know, you were allowed to be silly and irreverent at the same time as being very sad.
As you would at a good wake, I would have thought.
Yeah,
I've written a couple of things about this year. I wrote a piece about how Six Music on the day that he died was amazing. It just became this big wake. And it was people sharing, you know, the very well-known songs, the lesser-known songs, their memories of meeting him, kind of, or, you know, of first hearing his music. And there's, you know, that is, you know, it's about his life. It's not kind of doomy. It's kind of about celebrating what he had. And I wrote a piece in the last week for the Quietus website about public grief and how, you know, these people represent, you know, the life of the mind. And when people, you know, the grief police come up and they're like, you know, you're not allowed to grieve like this. You know, it's like, it's the life of the mind these people provide you. They give you opportunities and ideas and all this stuff, you know, and who would criticise that?
Anyway, let's move on to your next choice. Jude, I believe your next choice is Fleabag.
It's Fleabag. Yeah, which I watched, like many people do, kind of in fits and starts on, you know, iPlayer. It seemed to be this kind of It was first shown on BBC Three, interestingly, you know, which is now on online only, and has done some really interesting shows in the last year. And it was just this thing that sort of started to develop on social media, people saying, have you seen the latest episode? And it was released one a week. Phoebe Waller-Bridge, an actress who I'd noticed in a few things before. She was in the second series of Broadchurch. You know, she's very beautiful, but there's a kind of edge to every performance that she does. And the show, for those of you who haven't seen it, is about a woman who has whose best friend, who she ran a cafe with, has died, which sounds quite bleak. It starts with her making this hilarious joke about, can I say anal sex on this?
If you want to, you can.
Anal sex. Yes.
On a Sunday morning.
She makes this hilarious joke about it. When I first read about it, I thought, always desperately trying to be provocative and throwing, you know, kind of, right, you know, certain terms and ideas in your face. But it's a lot more sophisticated than that. I've heard it referred to as the hipster Miranda, which makes me laugh because she does turn to camera a lot and make kind of like raise an eyebrow when people are doing certain things. But it's about this loss she's had in her life. Her mum has died. It's about that background to it, which she doesn't talk about a lot. But as the series progresses, she has this very dark relationship with her dad, who obviously doesn't particularly care about his daughters. And she has this succession of terrible boyfriends, but there's an amazing twist at the end as well. But it just gets bleaker and bleaker. And if you're a woman in your you know 20s or 30s, you will identify, and you will identify with it. I think
they're showing it again over Christmas on BBC One. How Christmassy!
BBC One.
Well, I think it's BBC One after midnight when there's nobody left amazing. Except the people wolfing down the quality street with the brandy. I think possibly when you've been through a dismal family Christmas, you will want to see Fleabag's family is
it
even
is
worse.
It is very funny though, and it's got some amazing, you know, big actors. It's got Hugh Dennis plays this amazing bit part in it, and Olivia Colman plays the evil stepmother.
The biggest villain of the year. Worse than Donald Trump. She is.
Stephen Metcalf, who hosts the Slate Culture Gabfest, has this this great sort of theory about certain, you know, works of art, certain stories, that they're really grief memoirs. And he says, and you know, Catcher in the Rye is really a grief memoir. Bright Lights, Big City.
Yeah.
And Fleabag, I think, is as well. Mm. It's like fundamentally, it's about this great trauma. And like Catcher in the Rye and Bright Lights, Big City, it starts off and you think, she's kind of narcissistic, kind of obnoxious, kind of self-destructive. And it's only when you realise this sort of like deep well of pain and that she's not just some kind of... The 90s version would be she was just like a Ladette or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm. But you realise it's coming from a much deeper place. And, you know, comedies that are genuinely funny, but then at one point they just punch you in the gut emotionally.
Let's have your third choice, which is former guest on the show, Sylvia Patterson.
Sylvia Patterson's brilliant book, I'm Not With The Band. Some years ago, when we were both writing for Q Magazine, well, we both do write for Q Magazine still, I remember Sylvia saying that she was trying to write her memoirs, but who would want to read them and all this stuff. I'm like, you're Sylvia Patterson, you know, you are, you know, people have grown up with you, you know, with smash hits in the face and her fantastic style of writing. Sylvia's such a... Fearless sounds funny when you talk about music journalism, but she really doesn't, you know, she will just go and write what she thinks about people. Not in a mean way, but kind of she does proper journalism, you know, she'll kind of expose the way the industry works in really interesting ways. There's obviously got some great music stories in there. The Bernard Sumner story is still my favourite, when she accidentally writes about the groupies that he entertains himself with, and you know, later him and his wife break up. It's all been legal to this book, and I did say to Sylv, you know, what was the legal read like for this book? She went long, but there's also Sylvia's own story running through. You know, she's had, you know, a tough upbringing, lost her father, kind of in, you know, when she, you know, the early days of being a smash hits writer. But she writes about it in a really moving way, but not, you know, like a grief memoir. Sort of.
Yeah, and she's basically the co-architect of the smash hits vocabulary of, you know, Jumbo Rilliant and Spew Gusting Crimson Purpricks. She's, you know, lays a good claim to being the Dr. Samuel Johnson of our times. Well, because this is pop writing, nobody takes it seriously.
And she says, you know, this is why this journalism doesn't work in the same ways anymore. This is why the industry doesn't work anymore. Yeah. It's quite political with a small p about, you know, what's gone wrong about the music industry and stuff like that.
It's the arc of our whole business, isn't it? Mm. From you can go anywhere and talk to anyone about anything to you've been, you know, demoted to below the level of a Twitter stream.
Yeah.
And she's brilliant on it. And it's the most fantastic, compelling
read. Very funny.
Dorian, did you read it?
I did, and I loved it for... I suppose, again, there's that mix of just like funny stories and real kind of, you know, pain from her background, and then the kind of the sort of gloomy development in music journalism, because I think she just has that smash hits thing where it's like pop should be interesting and fun. And I think she's entirely right about the pressure of the internet and people's exposure on social media, the way that comments that used to just sit there in a magazine and wouldn't be picked up unless there was some diligent tabloid hack, can now go around instantly. And this is absurd, you know, sort of row she gets into with Warpaint over a fairly inoffensive thing they said about Beyonce, which turned into an internet storm. And you think, you know, I'm increasingly grateful for anybody I interview who is just interesting, who is just opinionated and isn't like locked down by that, because it's such a depressing...
gaming the future Twitter storm and censoring themselves.
I mean, it's such a you know, I've had this experience of interviewing people and she's basically going, well, I've talked about that before, I'm not going to talk about it now because it's too much trouble. And you think, oh, what a shame. Like, not what a shame for my piece, but also what a shame for you that you constantly have to censor yourself. And I think that I came away from Sylvia's book basically thinking that she had an ideology.
Yeah.
Like, this is what music journalism should be, which is a very different ideology to, like, 70s NME or Rolling Stone or 80s Melody Maker. But it was one that I realised, like, oh, my God, this has totally shaped me.
Yeah.
Smash hits, Sylvia in particular. I don't write like Sylvia, but it's really shaped my idea that this is kind of what you should be, this is what it should be about.
Yeah.
And so when she's writing about the good times, it's sort of utopian.
Yeah.
You just think, oh, my God, what a great... fabulous party it is. And I don't think it's dead now, but I think that there are all these factors mitigating against that.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on, Dorian, to your choices. I believe one of your choices is Unlikely Comebacks, specifically A Tribe Called Quest and The Avalanches. So we've tanned the A Tribe Called Quest album on the show. Well, here's a track from The Avalanches album, Wildflower. This is Some Ways.
You walk on the subway. You walk on the subway.
The Avalanches and Subways from the album Wildflower, one of Dorian Lynskey's favourite things of 2016. Dorian, tell us why.
Well, one reason I really love the Avalanches album is because my five-year-old daughter really loves it. And she goes, you walk on the sideway, it booms the ground. Which I think is a better lyric.
It is a better lyric.
It booms the ground.
Yeah.
And so her kind of pleasure in this record has been a part of my pleasure. But also I think that there's this thing that when I was in teens or 20s, the idea of someone coming back after 16 years for the Avalanches, 18 for Tribe Called Quest, it was just absurd. It would have just been like, you know, go away, you're old. What's the point? Yeah. Now I am also basically old.
Go away, Dorian.
I think that people should hang around forever and be paid handsomely for it. But more to the point, it was like, these shouldn't work. For one thing, the Avalanches, I think, is almost an impossible thing that they've done here, which is that if you spend years and years and years, you know, and going to some very dark places, losing a band member, financial problems, possibly drug problems, they talked about a lot of heavy stuff.
Yeah.
And this is the least heavy album.
Yeah, it's beautiful, isn't it?
It's this sort of rainbow river that just sort of flows, and there's joy, and the way that the production sounds, where it sounds constantly like there's a party happening in this room, but you can hear the one in the next room.
Yeah.
And someone's trying to tune in a radio, and someone's like having a barbecue on the beach, but it's also kind of psychedelic. And I don't quite know how they managed to keep that freshness.
I was listening to it earlier this week, and that is the thing about it. It's such a light record. It's so kind of full of air, but at the same time it's really dense.
You can tell
how meticulous they've been with it. It's the detail and the attention.
It could
so
easily just turn into a sludge of kind of grindy grunge of music.
Well, busy records are so hard to do, records that sound like basically a party, because it's, you know, because you've got to create the sort of space, and it's all about the layering. And you can't do a kind of, you know, you can't brick wall this stuff. And so all of that kind of, but to work on something for so long and make it sound as if it's just kind of like come out of you.
But they did scrap kind of a number of goes round.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, they haven't been working on these tracks for 16 years. And then with the Tribe one, obviously it's a different story. You addressed it on a previous podcast, you know, of this kind of. But the again,
it's a grief memoir.
It's a grief memoir.
Yeah, because their mates died.
Everything's a grief memoir. But the joy I got from that was partly the fact that their friendship, they reconnected.
Yeah.
They're the two like oldest friends in the band. They reconnected. Then midway through, Fife dies. But so you've got this sort of the joy of this friendship finally fixed, which is the joy of a lot of reunion records. And then the grief and dealing with it.
Yeah.
But then the fact that Q-Tip, who's really not prolific enough, I think he has a lot of self-doubt and spends too long on things. And but because he wished he had a deadline, he's like, I want to get this done, you know, within a within a year.
And they could not have hit a better deadline. It basically arrives in time for the end of the world.
Well, I interviewed Q-Tip at his house the day after the election,
which was...
And he has a framed letter from Hillary Clinton on his wall. So the whole thing was just like my job and the world. Everything was just sort of like folding into each other. And in that context, you hear a song like, you know, We the People or Conrad Tokyo. And you're like, oh, my God, you've made the first great sort of protest record of the Trump era.
Yeah, you've made What's Going On.
But you didn't know when they made it. There's actually reference to a female president in the album. Yeah. Mm. So they didn't expect that. And so they felt very strange about it. So it's like, I find it a really emotionally complicated record because it's political, it's fun, it's touching, it's sort of very sad in places.
Yeah.
And also it's the last record, which is very rare. Normally when people have a comeback record, you're like, what are you going to do next? Mm. And with this, it's like, no, this is it. Yeah. Fife's gone, the band is gone. And, you know, who expects someone to come back after 18 years with their final album and it to be a masterpiece?
I know.
So the capacity of pop to just keep surprising you is wonderful.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jude.
I loved how both records, you know, both bands to me, you think of a certain era in pop music when they were around. You know, there's a part of the turn of the century with the Avalanches where there were loads of bands doing interesting things with samples and playfulness and, you know, the kind of people on Warp Records and, you know, the Go team a little bit later. But it's almost, I don't know if it's like, you know, a long time has passed and it still sounds identifiably like that band then, but it still sounds very fresh. I don't know if, you know, it's come back into fashion because records, I think. Yeah, the kind of a Tribe Called Quest record, I only kind of got around to listening a couple of weeks ago and it really just, you know, as you say, this ongoing ridiculous debate, there are no political, you know, records, you know, which is kind of lazy because nobody listens to anything. But this one just feels like it's a real line in the sand, doesn't it? It's like, wow.
I feel that maybe this year is the point where it's just like, if you don't think there is political music anymore, you are straight up an idiot.
Yeah.
Like, it could not be more obvious.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, Dorian, your next choice. You've managed to wangle four choices out of your three, haven't you? So your film of the year, Spotlight, yeah?
Spotlight, yeah, because some of the films that I've really loved this year, like Arrival or Anomalisa, or Love and Friendship, they're oddities. They're very distinctive. They're quite arty. And Spotlight is an example of a film which I think often gets kind of dismissed slightly by cool people like myself. But you know, as it's middle brow, it's Oscar bait.
Remind the listeners in case they can't remember exactly which one it is. Come on.
Oh, okay. It won an Oscar. It's a film about the Boston Globe Spotlight section reporting the scandal of child abuse by priests in Boston. And it's a kind of film that I really love in the sense, a bit like sort of Zodiac in the sense that it's a process movie.
Yeah.
And it's all about uncovering information. And some of the best scenes are people just like in a dusty library pulling folders off and realizing how the cover-up happened.
Yeah.
And it's also a film about, it's very methodical, but it's also about institutions. It's like I've seen a lot of films set in Boston, but this has got this almost sort of wire-like sense of the institutions that make up a city. So you have you have the press, you have the church, you have the local government, and the ways in which things are covered up, sometimes malevolently and sometimes almost apathetically.
Yeah.
It's just like the way that things can go wrong, and there's not always villains. Sometimes it's just like the failings within institutions. And I just found it sort of how methodical and quiet and careful it was. So bracing, because it's the kind of thing that can so easily be dull.
The big problem that I've got with it is that all that I could think of was All the President's Men and the fact that, you know, that is the archetypal journalists digging deep into kind of like corruption and finding kind of teasing out a thread and watching everything kind of come tumbling down. And we didn't kind of, I don't felt there was the same sense of drama around Spotlight.
But in a sense, I like that because in the real story, it was like, this is what that kind of journalism is you're not generally meeting, you know, Deep Throat in the parking lot.
Yeah.
A lot of the time it is just like these little interviews.
Sat in the morgue,
and it was the way that everyone was reflected. So you have the conversations with the kind of, you know, the kind of sinisterly charming priests, but you've also got the interviews with the victims who are like, you know, these sort of working class Bostonians. You've got the lawyers. It was the sort of the panoramic sense of it is that the journalists are sort of the heroes, but they're not the only topic. It's a film about a city.
Yeah.
And it was much better film about Boston than Johnny Depp, Black Mass.
I like the fact that in Black Mass, Johnny Depp looks like Lawrence from Denham. Let's have a third choice, Dorian. I believe it's The People versus O.J. Simpson.
So really good year for television, generally. But yeah, this again, I suppose it was because it was about, one, it was about process, and it was about a city again. This is obviously the thing that I like. But also, it wrong-footed me a bit because at first I thought it was going to be a guilty pleasure. As soon as you see John Travolta as, I can't remember the lawyer, but it's
David Schwimmer.
David Schwimmer, who just spends all the time going around going, juice, juice. And it was just, I just thought this is going to be a hoot.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just kind of, it's got this sort of like veneer of schlock. And then underneath that, the stuff it's saying about race, about gender, I think Sarah Paulson as the prosecutor, the way that she is treated by the media, the way that Johnny Cochran plays the media, the way that, in fact, this is a really complicated case because in terms of racial politics, you are on the side of Johnny Cochran. He is right about the LAPD.
Yeah.
It's just OJ was guilty.
Yes.
That's what makes it so complicated in terms of, again, it's very hard to find sort of heroes and villains. It's just this giant mess, and the care with which it pulled out all these sort of threads while still being very faithful to the truth. And yet you still had Travolta and Schwimmer and little jokes about young Kim Kardashian.
Well, yeah, I mean, who'd have thought that we all thought the fallout from this was going to be race war, and actually the fallout of it was even worse. It was the Kardashians. Okay, let's move on. Matt, we're going to do your choices, Matt Hall's choices, starting with a track from your album of the year, which is Beyonce's Lemonade. This is Formation.
Y'all haters corny with that Illuminati mess. Paparazzi, catch my fly and my cocky fresh.
Formation, I slay. Who to me, you got some coordination.
I slay.
Slay trick, are you getting lemonade?
From Matt Hall's album of the year, Lemonade by Beyonce, that was Formation. Why this in particular? Come on, Matt, what's it doing for you?
Firstly, it's a fantastic piece of music. It's brilliant. It's kind of, and it's a thing that R&B has done for the last couple of decades. They've actually managed, that there's a tradition, probably ever since kind of Timbaland came out, of really being sonically adventurous and gathering up all the kind of weird stuff that happens on the margins and putting it into massive pop records and making it really popular. And this does that really well. This has kind of, you know, production by kind of James Blake, which is just, you just think that's, what kind of strange world do you get where you have the biggest pop star in the world
that
kind of ringing
up? Meeting, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, but it's brilliant. And you've got kind of the way on the lead single on Hold Up, you've got kind of, a weird kind of Bacharach and David. So you've got kind of a Massive Attack, Smith and Mighty thing going on, but it's all filtered like, insanely. So it sounds like, Dorian was saying, it sounds like a party not in the same room, but kind of on the other side of the street, you know, some weird party where they're playing kind of Bashment and Bacharach and David at the same time. and she's just brilliant. She's a brilliant pop star. You know, she's got everything that a pop star needs. She's got a fantastic image. She says really interesting things. She's multi-layered, so that, you know, the music's brilliant, but actually as soon as you start digging down, there's a whole load of different references that you've got. She's also got the ubiquitous Kendrick Lamar, which every album that came out this year that's even remotely decent had to have on. So I accept possibly, is he on the Avalanche's album? I don't know. But that's probably the only one that he's not on.
Yeah, he might be spreading himself a little thin. No, he's incredible here.
But and it's just and then we, you know, and I'm purely talking kind of about the music here, but the whole visual aspects of it and the film and the and the Super Bowl appearance. And
well, I mean, this was the year when she was kind of elevated from, you know, from the lowly position of world's biggest R&B pop star to another level of kind of some kind of socio-political goddess.
Yeah.
And as Dorian was just saying, if you don't think there's any political music around now, you're probably not really listening to anything.
My favourite fact about this album is she also samples something that Shirley Collins recorded.
Right.
Yes. I proved this by emailing Shirley, my close personal friend, last night, saying, were you present when Alan Lomax... because on the credits it says Alan Lomax.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm.
She was there, she did the tape. And she was like, I didn't know I was on the Beyoncé album. Tell me all about it, what's she done? And, you know, Beyoncé is not Shirley Collins' kind of music, but she's quite interested in people who do political things. So later I'll be emailing Shirley the track and telling her about all about
Six Degrees of Beyoncé.
Shirley and Kendrick together.
This is better than Chaz and Dave on Eminem, isn't it?
There's also a King Crimson sample somewhere on the album. Are you just going like... Again, like James Blake, it's like the thought of a King Crimson track being them sitting around and listening to the Court of the Crimson
but
King.
But again,
going,
it's another sort of surprise, because you think if someone goes, yeah, Beyoncé's done a record and it's got Jack White on it, it's got James Blake, it's Kendrick Lamar, there's a song that's Diplo, Ezra from Vampire Weekend and Father John Misty all worked on. And you're just thinking, this is going to be like a hot mess. There's no way. And the vision necessary to pull all that together is sort of phenomenal. And then to basically reframe the record with the visuals and the like the Super Bowl performance. Because lyrically, it's mostly about marital betrayal and forgiveness. There's a handful of political lines, information and freedom. But mostly it's about that. But because of the performance, because of the movie, it's so much bigger. And you just think, oh my God, that's how you do it now. You add all these layers of meaning and politics that maybe are not actually in the song line by line, but they become part of the thing. And I just felt that there were so many ways of enjoying this record. You could just enjoy the music, you can enjoy the film, you can enjoy the talking about the record.
That Super Bowl performance is amazing. I watched it again the other day. You know, the fact that she's there kind of wearing an outfit that is like, you know, Michael Jackson at the height of his powers, but she's kind of, they're there in an X and all the girls are kind of wearing the kind of Black Panther
and God bless
it's just like incredible.
And God bless Coldplay for basically ruining their own Super Bowl performance, because it was them and they were just like, and now our friend Beyonce, who's just like, might as well have just like had them shot, because no one remembers that they did the same.
Did she actually drop the mic at the end of the performance? Because she might well have.
Chris might have been like, oh, I don't know, maybe we shouldn't have done do that.
Okay, we're going to need to crack on here, otherwise it's going to be a 4-hour show. Matt, your second choice, The Hateful Eight, Tarantino.
Yeah, I was kind of looking at the films that I'd seen, watched this year, and there's such a lot of kind of big kind of superhero movies and statement movies that came out in the second half of the year. And then I realised that right at the very beginning, I'd seen this insane thing that was 3 hours long and shot on 70mm film and mainly set in one room with like totally scene-chewing performances by pretty much every actor that kind of appeared. When you think about it now, it's kind of quite interesting about how it was talking about race and politics and America and healing. And there's actually quite a lot of things that have gone on since that you think that's quite an interesting take on it. And I'm not saying that Tarantino is the best filmmaker ever. I think he's got a lot of fanboys who kind of big up everything he does without much reason. But I thought it's still a really chewy film and something that, and it was a Western. It had an Ennio Morricone soundtrack.
Mm. So. Is it a startling return to form? Like David Bowie.
Do you know what? So who cares? I don't, you know, it's probably not up there with his best films, but it's still the sort of film that very few other people could do or get away with or a studio allow to do. And I just think that's kind of...
He's sort of steering into his quirks more and more, because it's like any criticisms people make of Tarantino films. Films are too long. There's too much talking. You're obsessed with sort of genre revenge fantasies. And he's like, right, 3 hours, one room... Western, revenge, endless conversations. It's sort of like, it's such a kind of brilliantly kind of defiant thing. It's not one of my favourite films of his story. I do actually think it's too long. But there's just a way that he seems to be, he's not concerned about kind of, oh, this could be my Oscar movie, or this could be my big box office comeback. He's just like, no, this is the thing that I like to do.
Yeah, and it's kind of sad that we moan about a guy who really loves dialogue. You know, dialogue. Yeah. If it was David Mamet, we'd be like, oh, yeah, amazing, amazing.
And really loves cinema.
Yeah.
You know, you know, that whole thing about shooting on 70mm and showing on 70mm, you know,
He's not shooting it in one room. On yeah,
I know. It's kind of slightly mad that you've got, like, you know, Kurt Russell's face the size of a house in front of you. But
there we go. Yeah. Well, sticking with Mindless Violence, I believe your third choice is Peaky Blinders.
Yeah, which is just, it's on the third series. I think it might well have jumped the shark in the last episode, but it's been recommissioned for two more series. It's got, apparently, the fans of Birmingham City now all wear Peaky Blinders caps. So it's got
like
kind
David
of like
Bowie.
There's a resonance that it's kind of reached out of its. No, I don't think they have blades in them. And you know, it's made a star out of Cillian Murphy. It's got some great. The style is kind of Godfather 2, really sharp suits. Yeah. Transferred to kind of Walsall, which is slightly strange. It's got some brilliant performances. It's got some great villains. Sam Neill in the first series, Paddy Considine in the third series as the paedophile priest.
There's Helen McCrory is in it
Helen
as well.
Helen McCrory
yeah, she's
is absolutely
so great.
Fantastic.
Paedophile priest, obviously a big thing this year. Yeah.
Tom Hardy chews every set up that he walks onto as this kind of Jewish gangster.
Is he worse than Bane?
He's about as audible and understandable.
Right.
And he hasn't got the excuse of wearing a mask.
He just walks onto a set and everything he does, and he just goes, oh. That's what he does, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's great.
In a really charismatic, entertaining way.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Because you see, and we've had politicians doing this moaning, why can't the BBC make The Wire? Why can't the BBC make The Surprise? Well, it is. It's Peaky Blinders.
And there are some things that you think they copied straight from The Wire playbook, like the kind of Nick Cave song on the soundtrack for Red Right Hand and stuff, and you just think that, you know, that juxtaposition of modern music with kind of 1920s Birmingham was a little bit jarring at the start, but as you get into it, you kind of notice it less and less.
Okay, right, now it's my turn. I'm going to impose my taste.
You've all been waiting.
Yeah, I'm going to impose my taste on everyone. We're going to start with pretty much my favourite single of 2016. It's a proper, full-on glitterball disco monster. We're going to get this show without playing a single rock record. From Southport, it's Lapsley with the DJ Cozy mix of Operator. Cozy mix, the strings, the space, the melody. I would love her to do much more of this, and I especially love the Fall in Love With You proper sort of soul phrase in there. Do we love it, Dorian? I believe you have your second favorite single of the year.
It is for some reason my first favorite is bizarrely by the Monkees, because it's a song that just breaks me in two, me and Madalena. But then this just reminds me of kind of countless house records that I've really loved. You know, when you would have a proper remix, you know, where they respect the song and just sort of reimagine it and sort of almost erase the memory of the original song, go, and this is what it was meant to be. It was meant to be a disco song. Yeah. And every production detail is just perfect and magical and references things I love without being a kind of pastiche.
Yeah, it's a bit Philly, it's a bit Chicago, it's a bit Detroit. Yeah. Fundamentally, all good records are disco records, aren't they?
Yes.
They are.
Yes, it's fantastic. Anything that's got a sound of a phone in it, I love. You know, it feels quite old fashioned here.
The extended cowbell breakdown as well.
Oh yeah,
but it's like when Dimitri from Paris used to do remixes, and he just liked all this stuff that people like Shep Pettibone used in the '80s. And so if you were kind of into that stuff, there were all these little kind of Easter eggs and in jokes and like, oh, you like this sound as well. Yeah. And this is full of those who just like, oh, I love it when records do that. And it's like just like 9 minutes of all the things I like in dance records.
So well done, Lapsley. Well done, DJ Cozy. My second choice, Westworld, the most engrossing, most thought-provoking TV show of the year, does an even better job of what Battlestar Galactica started, which is you take some much-loved bit of 70s cheese and you update it beyond any imagining. You actually turn it into a completely different, a much superior show. I mean, I just love the fact that, you know, it's taken things like Theory of Mind, it's taken the morality of video games, put them in an absolutely engrossing narrative. People moan that you can't really understand it unless you sit there Googling and you know, following the message boards alongside it. I think that's a feature, not a bug. I love the fact that we've got complex TV that you've got to think about and ask people about. Matt, you're watching it, aren't you?
I've watched a couple of episodes. I'm not as much of a fan of it as you are. I think they've done a really good job in the look of it, in that the juxtaposition of the shiny, robotic kind of environments yeah. with the dusty Western
yeah.
sets, I think is really good. I think it's quite cold. I kind of see that's what they're kind of going for. Yeah. I find it very difficult to empathise with anybody, robot or human.
Is it not a grief memoir? Is this what you're telling me?
It's a grief memoir for the human race. I mean, to me, the beautiful thing about is that I sympathise with the robots enormously because they live a romantic life, and in some respects, it's an incredibly kitschy life because they're living out the fantasy of the Old West.
Andrew, they're robots.
I know, but the whole show is that's what it's about. Just because they're robots doesn't mean they can't be conscious. It doesn't mean they don't have moral being. It doesn't mean they should be treated as objects.
I think we should make a big bonfire of all our iPhones and mobile phones and iPads now, quick, before it starts.
The kind of the ancestor of Westworld is of course that great car phone warehouse advert where you see a sad phone walking in the rain and nobody cares about that phone. It makes my missus cry whenever she sees that monitor. But it's like, well, if you're going to imbue your technology with human characteristics, which of course we will do when robots arrive because we will want them to be beautiful. We want them to be great things to be around. So if they've got human characteristics and they behave in a human way, aren't they worthy of being treated as a human? It means you can't just shoot them or abuse them for your own gratification. And I think it's an incredibly pertinent show because what you're seeing on television is what's been going on for years and years in the environment of video games. Red Dead Redemption, Grand Theft Auto, people have been shooting, and worse, fictional characters for their own gratification. Well, what's that saying about human appetite? To me, the great thing about Westworld is it is fundamentally Lord of the Flies.
But couldn't you have had those arguments about kind of Sven Hassel books in the kind of 1970s?
Yeah, you can. And, and we have had those arguments, but we have not yet. Soon we're going to have to encounter how do we treat artificial minds? Do we give them a vote? Do we listen to them? Are we able to kill them off if they displease us? And that's what it's really about. It is, are we going to be ready for the future in which we're not the only thinking thing in the world? And I think to get that on primetime television is an incredible achievement. And the fact that people talk about it so much is, it wasn't so long ago that we were terrified that television was going to turn us into idiots incapable of stringing together an argument. The finale of Westworld talks about the theory of the
bicameral.
This is not a spoiler. But
this is the next thing I'm watching.
The episode is called The Bicameral Mind, and it's about how does the human mind work. I mean, that on primetime television?
Yeah.
It makes my ruinously expensive Sky subscription feel really...
Well, now it's the internet that's meant to turn us into dribbling idiots incapable of stringing
sentences
together.
It's doing a pretty good job
together.
So far, as I can see.
Yeah, that's why you don't get songs about how there ain't nothing on TV no more, because TV's really good, but instead you get songs about, like, I feel weird about my phone.
Yeah.
It's like...
It'd be great if disposable heroes of hypocrisy came back and did... The internet, the drug of the nation, it's making you all into morons.
Or Bruce Springsteen did that 57 channels and nothing's on.
But Bruce needs to look at his package then because I don't know what. I think he needs to.
He's HBO Go.
Yeah, absolutely. Get on Netflix, Bruce. You'll never make another album again. Excellent. My next choice, my final choice is. It is on Netflix. It's Stranger Things, which is a fantastic trip back to the 80s, if you're old enough. But what I really liked is the fact that my nieces and nephews really dug it, and they were not even around in the 20th century, let alone the 80s. It's got everything you could possibly relate to. It's about being a teenager. It's about going out into the world that the grown-ups don't understand and having to deal with it. Jude, did you watch it?
I haven't seen it yet.
Ah, right. No, okay.
Basically, I've spent 4 months of this year without a telly. Ah. So 2017 is going to be the year of 2016 for me. Now, it just, like, all the references sound completely me. I like the fact that the people mentioned it's got a sort of Twin Peaks-y sensibility to it. There's loads of references to 80s films, and obviously that was when I was a child, so kind of I'm going to get lots of
John Carpenter, E.T., Stephen King.
Oh, amazing.
Well, I was writing about sort of 80s-influenced music about a year ago, and I came up with this idea of the platonic 80s, which is records that sound like what you sort of remember the 80s being, but filtered through movies, like 1975, too young for the 80s.
Yeah.
But they sort of think, well, I'm sure the 80s sounded and looked like John Hughes movies or whatever. And this was like that with Stephen King and Spielberg and John Carpenter and all those things. And it was sort of playing, as well as just being a really good sort of sci-fi yarn and a coming-of-age story, it's also playing with this idea of how the sense we have, our sense of an era, particularly if you're a younger listener, is constructed by all these artifacts, and it's not like the 80s. The Americans is the 80s as the 80s was,
right?
Yeah.
Which is a lot sort of it's a bit drabber and uglier.
Yeah.
Whereas this is this sort of magical, glowing, spooky.
Yeah.
You're listening to Melt With You by Modern English while you know.
And the Bonnie Man.
While cycling around like someone in E.T.
Yeah.
You know,
it sounds like you know, it's 15 years now since Donnie Darko, but kind of like when people talk about it, people, it sounds like that was a massive.
It's really like Donnie Darko. It's like the 80s, Donnie Darko, Stranger Things.
Yeah.
Is that, are those films going to be kind of remade, or that tone going to be remade? Well, so all of a sudden you've got 80s films being made.
Well, you saw J.J. Abrams
in the 60s
doing,
or whatever.
It's the tone that's so key. Yeah.
Super 8 was effectively a prequel to this, wasn't it? It was kind of you know, J.J. Abrams' film about a bunch of kids on bikes with cameras and crazy stuff starts happening in their small town. So it's in the ether. It's not. And you know, obviously there's a cycle to this, isn't there? You know, people who watch these films when they were teenagers are, when they're in their 40s, they are the power in Hollywood, and they're going to want to make the stuff that, you know, for the same reason that we saw, you know, the Big Chill happening in the 80s. It was, you know, it was you want to recap your childhood.
And casting Winona Ryder.
Yeah.
It's, again, it's like the kind of biggest sort of 80s in joke.
Yeah. I noticed, by the way, that Molly Ringwald has stopped doing her kind of a column in The Guardian, so maybe she's... doing other things at the moment as well.
Return of the Ringwald.
Yeah.
That's very Molly Ringwald's advice column is like every girl's dream in the 80s to have Molly Ringwald be your agony aunt. It was
mine
anyway.
It's a strange thing, a word for Barb, who was the only person who looks exactly like somebody in the 80s. Most people in the 80s did look, which is terrible.
Yeah.
Got bad glasses, bad hair, bad coat.
And no spoilers, but, you know, let's just have a moment to think of Barb. Because I think that's the if the dreadful face of 2016 was Donald Trump, then the face we will always remember on the positive side is Barb from Stranger Things. So there we go. Those were a few of our favourite things of 2016. Thanks to our guests, Jude Rogers and Dorian Linsky. We've got one more show before Christmas, so we'll see you in 7 days' time. Remember, you can hear this show again and all of our shows at audioboom.com. Just go there and search for Big Mouth. You can subscribe at the iTunes Music Store. Again, go there, search for Big Mouth. And of course, if you give us a star rating, that would be great. We are going to experiment with putting the podcast out a day early on Saturdays, so you can subscribe and hear it before everybody else. Although, of course, if you listen on Soho Radio, you will get to hear all of the tunes in full. And we have got time for one more song, and I'm choosing it. It's one of the best singles of the year, All the Romance of Pop in a Single Song, from their fantastic album Super. It's the Pet Shop Boys with the Pop Kids, because no matter how old and decrepit we get on Big Mouth, we remain Pop Kids at heart. See you next week.